Well, welcome everyone, and our topic tonight is Roman Catholicism today. Martin Lloyd-Jones gave a lecture back in 1967 at the British Evangelical Council Conference. The lecture was entitled Luther and His Message for Today. Inevitably, in the course of the lecture, Lloyd-Jones strongly criticised certain aspects of Roman Catholic teaching. He then anticipated the following objection. I quote, "But someone may object at this point and say, but are you not forgetting that Rome is changing? Are you not yourself falling back to the 16th century? Have you not been carried away by Luther? Are you forgetting that you were living in 1967 and that Rome is changing? All right, let us examine the change. The Church of Rome today is not identical with the Church in Luther's day." Lloyd-Jones then pointed out several ways in which Roman Catholicism today has indeed changed and is different from what Martin Luther faced in the 16th century. The most important difference that Lloyd-Jones highlighted, I would suggest, was his final one. Again, I quote, "Then others say, what about their new attitude to the Bible? Let us face it. Did you know that the new attitude to the Bible in the Roman Church is mainly the higher critical attitude, and that what is coming into the Roman Church is modernism, liberalism, higher criticism, not evangelicalism? Do not be deluded, my friends. Those are the facts concerning the Roman Catholic Church." Now, my talk this evening is really an exploration of the two basic points that Lloyd-Jones made in 1967. Both points are crucial if we're to have anything like a right understanding of present-day Roman Catholicism. First, Rome has changed since the time of the Reformation. It is pointless pretending that this is not so and refighting the battles of the past when the battle lines have been redrawn. That would be like Britain basing its defence policy on the threat of a new conflict with Nazi Germany. Laughable, you may say. Yet something akin to that would be what we were doing if we based our attitude to Roman Catholicism on the obsolete battle lines of the 16th century. Those battle lines were seriously and fundamentally redrawn by the Second Vatican Council, which met from 1962 to 65. This was a global assembly of Roman Catholic clergy and theologians that met in Rome to enact reform within their religious communion. The Second Vatican Council was undoubtedly the watershed that marked the birth of modern Roman Catholicism. It's called the second in succession to the First Vatican Council of 1869 to 70. The two councils are often referred to in shorthand simply as Vatican I and Vatican II. Vatican I was the council that for the first time defined the nature of the infallibility of the Pope and made this a positive dogma binding on the faithful. That council broke up without being officially dissolved, owing to the invasion and occupation of Rome by the army of Victor Emmanuel, king of the newly united Italy. The Second Vatican Council, Vatican II, was therefore perceived by many as a sort of continuation of Vatican I, resuming and completing its work. When Vatican II undertook that task, however, the whole climate of thought within Roman Catholicism had changed, and the results would undoubtedly have shocked most of those who had taken part in Vatican I. Martin Lloyd-Jones then, speaking in 1967, only 2 years after the conclusion of Vatican II, recognised very clearly what winds of change that council had unleashed within the Roman Catholic communion. If we today would grapple truthfully with modern Rome, I suggest as a matter of urgency that we must follow in Lloyd-Jones' footsteps. we must candidly acknowledge the reality of the change that has taken place in Roman Catholic theology and seek to understand its nature and implications. That's the first point. And then second, the most significant aspect of this change lies in a new attitude to divine revelation on the part of Roman Catholic theology. A new attitude to divine revelation. Lloyd-Jones expresses this in terms of Rome's attitude to the Bible, embracing liberal Protestant ideas of its limited inspiration and accuracy. We can perhaps expand Lloyd-Jones' point by asking about Rome's attitude to truth. In what sense does the Bible contain exclusive religious truth? And in what sense is that truth necessary to salvation? These two related questions take us into the heart of modern Roman Catholicism. Now, we'll see later what this involves. But here is a real and critical change in mainstream Roman Catholic thinking, and it has rendered most of the past controversies redundant. We're in genuinely new territory in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, as Lloyd-Jones rightly perceived. I reiterate his cry. Do not be deluded, my friends. Those are the facts concerning the Roman Catholic Church. A new appreciation and a new critique are called for on the part of Christians who still resist the claims of Rome. If we're to be honest and not live in the past. Now, in order to understand what happened at Vatican II, we need to step back and take a bird's eye view of Roman Catholic theology in the 100 years or so that preceded the council. No important event in history suddenly pops into being without causes or a background. There were streams of influence flowing within the Roman Catholic communion that finally burst forth in the Second Vatican Council and its decisions. Part of the problem for the great majority of Protestants and evangelicals is simply that we know little or nothing of the history of Roman Catholicism after the turmoil and conflicts of the Reformation era in the 16th century. We could, each of us, no doubt, without difficulty, name 6 Protestant theologians, preachers, or devotional writers who have lived and worked since the days of Luther and Calvin. How many of us could name 6 Roman Catholic theologians, preachers, or devotional writers who've lived and worked since that time? Therein lies the problem. It is not our history, and perhaps inevitably, most of us know little or nothing about it. And consequently, we tend to view all Roman Catholicism through the distorting lens of the 16th century conflict. But you see, Roman Catholicism no more stood still than Protestantism did. It developed in all kinds of ways. It had its internal problems and struggles. It interacted with the changes in society brought on by such events as the rise of science, the Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, the French Revolution, the advent of modern secular democracy and nationalism. It had its own distinguished men and women, theologians, philosophers, poets, humanitarian workers, missionaries, whatever we may think of them. So, let's try in broad brush strokes to paint a rudimentary picture of what was going on within Roman Catholic theology in the century that led up to the Second Vatican Council. Prior to Vatican II, the official theology of the Roman Catholic Communion was Neo-Thomism, named after Thomas Aquinas, greatest of the Catholic theologians of the Middle Ages. Thomism, the theology of Thomas. Hence, Neo-Thomism, the new Thomism. Neo-Thomism was a revamped Thomism, adapted and fine-tuned to the purpose of rescuing the Church from an increasing diversity of ideas and theologies that had emerged in the early 19th century. Because Thomas and the theologians of the Middle Ages were known as scholastic theologians, we also come across the term neo-scholasticism to describe this 19th century movement within Roman Catholicism. So then there was this attempt within the Roman Catholic communion to revive, to rehabilitate medieval scholastic theology in general, and Thomism in particular, from around 1840 onwards. Neo-Thomism especially was given the official seal of approval in Pope Leo XIII's encyclical letter Aeterni Patris of 1879, where Leo named Thomas as the great theologian of the church. Now, this is the kind of Roman Catholicism still portrayed in popular Protestant books on the subject. For example, in the classic 1962 volume Roman Catholicism by the Reformed writer Lorraine Bettner. This was published during the early stages of the Second Vatican Council, but rather misleadingly, it describes the theology which had prevailed in Rome up to that point. This was the theology that was officially neo-Thomist and was also committed to upholding the teachings of the great Council of Trent, the 16th century Roman Catholic Council, which had reacted to the Reformation and formulated its views in opposition to it. However, even during this era, when neo-Thomism was the official reigning theology, liberal ideas in various forms were circulating within Roman Catholicism. And these liberal ideas were collectively known as modernism. The leading modernist theologians within Roman Catholicism at that time were the German Baron Friedrich von Hugel, 1852 to 1925, the Englishman George Tyrrell, 1861 to 1909, and the French thinkers Alfred Loisy, 1857 to 1940, and Maurice Blondel, 1861 to 1949. Now, the essence of Roman Catholic modernism was to reshape Roman Catholic theology much along the lines of liberal Protestantism, and its leading thinker, Friedrich Schleiermacher, 1768 to 1834. Schleiermacher had radically reinterpreted and reformatted Protestant theology in this way. Rather than the teaching of an infallible Bible, Schleiermacher made man's religious experience the heart of his theology. He was trying to respond to the challenges of the 18th century Enlightenment, which saw the traditional arguments for the existence of God rejected by leading philosophers. It also saw the historical reliability of the Bible questioned within the church by critical scholars. Schleiermacher thought he could rescue Christianity from these assaults of skepticism. His method has been described thus: take heart, all is not lost. Religion does not need outside evidence to justify its existence. Religion is not knowledge, whether in the form of creeds, doctrines, or the content of sacred books. It does not need philosophical reflection either. The essence of religion is piety, and piety is feeling. If you have a feeling of dependence on God, you have all that is necessary to make you a member of the worldwide communion of saints or company of the truly religious. The separate beliefs and practices of the various religions scattered through time and space are simply different ways, all more or less valid, of cultivating and expressing this fundamental instinct or attitude, the feeling of dependence, which by itself is sufficient. Now, Schleiermacher was eminently successful in persuading many Protestants to follow his program for reformatting Christianity in terms of human religious feeling and experience. The Roman Catholic modernists pursued a similar path, often with explicit reliance on Schleiermacher. Baron von Hugel, for example, was a disciple of Schleiermacher, and he introduced the great English Roman Catholic modernist George Tyrrell to Schleiermacher's writings. These modernist ideas, then, parallel to liberal Protestantism, were circulating among Roman Catholics, even during the heyday of Neo-Thomism. But they didn't escape criticism and censure. Pope Pius X, Pope from 1903 to 14, condemned modernism in his decree Lamentabili and his encyclical letter Pascendi Dominici Gregis, both issued in 1907. He described modernism as the synthesis of all heresies. The Roman Catholic modernist thinkers, such as von Hugel, Tyrrell, Loisy and Blondel, thus became the object of official scorn and rejection. Tyrrell and Loisy, indeed, were excommunicated. However, the modernist seeds had been sown, and looming in the background stood the titanic figure of Cardinal John Henry Newman, 1801 to 1890. Newman had, of course, been a prominent Anglican, but had converted to Rome in 1845. Now, Newman was not really a theological liberal or modernist at heart, but in the process of his conversion to Rome, he wrote what was to become a key text for many liberalizing Roman Catholic theologians, both in the modernist crisis and later at the time of Vatican II. This was Newman's An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine. Now, Newman's purpose in this essay was to put forward a new argument for the truth of Roman Catholicism. Prior to Newman, Roman Catholic apologists had maintained that Rome was the unchanging church founded by the apostles and carried on by the early church fathers, that modern Roman dogma and practice accorded precisely with the apostolic and patristic church of the first few centuries, including such things as the papacy, indulgences, purgatory, Rome's Mariology, etc. Protestantism, by contrast, was marked by continual change and development, and therefore could not be in possession of the truth. Now, to any Protestant who knew the history of the first 400 years of Christianity, this Roman Catholic thesis was laughable. Newman perceived this and turned the argument on its head. Development, he argues, is actually the sign of truth. Ideas are like seeds. When first planted, they have a primitive simplicity about them. Their full meaning and potential are unfolded as they grow through conflict with opposing ideas. When Christ and his apostles planted the seed of Christianity, therefore, one would expect to see a growing organism which evolves and changes through the centuries, bringing to maturity more and more of its hidden potential. This, Newman contends, is precisely what we see in the Roman Catholic Church, which, of course, he identified with the apostolic and patristic church. But we see no such organic process of growth and development in Protestantism, which is wedded to the sterile and stagnant idea of reproducing first century primitive Christianity. Newman used his philosophy of development to justify all those features of Roman Catholic theology, piety and worship, which Protestants have historically regarded as betrayals of the early church. Roman Catholic Mariology, for example, with its doctrine of the Virgin's Immaculate Conception, was for Newman not a betrayal, but a development, an unfolding of a seed idea found in Scripture and the Fathers, although made explicit only later. In this way, Newman turned the edge of the Protestant critique that Roman Catholicism did not look much like the Church of the Apostles or the early Fathers. Does an oak tree look like an acorn? Now, to be fair, Newman recognised that there could be illegitimate developments, corruptions, and he outlined a complex scheme of seven tests by which to distinguish these from proper developments. But in his own mind, he was perfectly convinced that 19th century Roman Catholicism was the historical continuation of first century apostolic Christianity. The early church was the primitive, undeveloped infant. Roman Catholicism is the mature and majestic man. Now, Newman's philosophy of development has won the day in modern Rome. Very few defenders of the old view can now be found. A cursory reading of modern Roman Catholic histories of the church and of theology will reveal Newman's assumptions at work. It has liberated Roman Catholics from the unenviable burden of trying to prove that everything they believe and practice today was believed and practiced by the apostles. Of course, Newman's development thesis also chimes in with the pervasive evolutionary mindset of 21st century man. Like life itself, church and theology have evolved. Now, Newman didn't write his essay on the development of Christian doctrine to justify modernism, but his ideas on how Christianity has changed and developed through the centuries were eventually to give comfort and inspiration to those Roman Catholics who wanted to reject the rigid theology of Neo-Thomism and instead promote modernist thinking. If Newman was right, and Christian doctrine had undergone this long process of development, then why should the church canonize the doctrine of one limited time period, the time of Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century? Could things not develop still further? Could modernist thinking not be the development needed to meet the challenges of the 19th and 20th centuries? Now, the official condemnation of modernism by Pope Pius X in 1907 and the entrenchment of Neo-Thomism in the official theological training of Roman Catholic priests did not entirely halt the spread of modernist ideas. And after the First World War, a new generation of Roman Catholic thinkers emerged who began to grapple again with the same sorts of ideas which had been condemned in 1907. Among this new generation, outstanding figures included the German theologian Karl Rahner, 1904-84, the Swiss Hans Urs von Balthasar, 1905-88, and the French thinkers Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, 1881-1955, Henri de Lubac, 1896-1991, and Yves Congar, 1904-95. The activities of such men gave rise to a broad school of thought known as the Nouvelle Théologie, the New Theology. The movement is also known as Ressourcement, which has the idea of going back to the original sources and making them live again, the sources being the Bible and the early church fathers. In fact, Ressourcement was the name preferred by the practitioners of this school of thought. It was their Neo-Thomist enemies who called it Nouvelle Theology, New Theology, meaning a novel, unheard of theology, an invention never before seen. But Nouvelle Theology was the name that stuck. Now, the goal of these theologians was a reformation of the whole approach to theology within Roman Catholicism. In particular, they questioned three things. One, the reigning orthodoxy of Neo-Thomist scholastic theology. Two, the negative, defensive attitude of their religious communion towards modern civilization. And three, its negative, defensive attitude towards other faiths, including both other forms of Christianity and non-Christian religions. The Nouvelle Théologie thinkers tried to correct these errors, as they considered them, by exposing Roman Catholic theology to the liberating influences of the Bible and the early church fathers. However, what this often really meant, it must be said, was the Bible and the fathers as interpreted by the Nouvelle Théologie. Together with this, they also advocated and practiced a broad openness to dialogue with the modern world, especially on matters of religion. Other aspects of the Nouvelle Theology were a fresh interest in art, literature, and mysticism. Essentially, what the Nouvelle Theology was seeking to do was free Roman Catholics from the straitjacket of Neo-Thomist orthodoxy by making all theology relative rather than absolute. The truth revealed by God, they argued, was not a set of ideas, but a person, Jesus Christ. Ideas were a human response to Christ, and these ideas were always inadequate, always caught up in the flux of time and culture. There were different theologies held by different people at different times in the rich, diverse history of the church. Therefore, no one single theology, such as Thomism, could be canonized and made absolute. Rather, theologians ought to engage with the different historical varieties of theology and find tools there to construct a positive response to present-day challenges. Well, here were many of the themes of late 19th century modernism in a new dress. Like modernism, the Nouvelle Theology also met with official criticism from the Roman Catholic hierarchy. This criticism was expressed in the encyclical Humani Generis of Pope Pius XII, issued in 1950. However, as Reformed theologian David Wells says, the encyclical was so mild in its wording, it can hardly even be seen as a rebuke. The work of the new theologians was not imperiled, still less consigned to the graveyard of heresy. After a further decade of study, their conclusions seemed sufficiently safe and fruitful to be given papal approval. The opportunity for the Nouvelle Theology to change the official face of Roman Catholicism came with the election of a new pope on October the 28th, 1958. His personal name was Angelo Giuseppe Ronsali. He took the papal name John XXIII. Unlike his predecessor, Pius XII, the new pope, although already an old man, was susceptible to the modernizing agenda of the Nouvelle Theology. John XXIII profoundly believed that for a church living in the second half of the 20th century, it wasn't sufficient to stand still and just repeat everything it had said in the past. It was necessary, instead, to embark on a radical process of what he called aggiornamento. That's an Italian word meaning something like bringing things up to date. His instrument for achieving this would be a second Vatican Council. Thus, when John XXIII summoned Vatican II in 1962, his specific intention was not merely repeating or even clarifying what had been taught in the past, but rather bringing about a religious leap forward, making Roman Catholicism more open to the transformed situation of 20th century man. As the Pope made clear in his address which inaugurated the council, his justification was that the substance of the ancient doctrine of the deposit of the faith is one thing, and the way in which it is presented is another. This distinction between the substance of the faith and the way it is presented was amenable to a Nouvelle Theology interpretation. The substance was the person of Christ. The presentation was changeable theological ideas. The result at Vatican II was a clash of theologies and their representatives, with the Neo-Thomist traditionalists fighting the modernizers of the Nouvelle Theology. As David Wells recounts, when the two parties came into conflict with each other, three outcomes were possible. On rare occasions, one side prevailed unequivocally. Sometimes, when neither side backed down, a reconciling statement was drawn up, which was ambiguous enough to mean different things to the two parties. And sometimes, no such reconciling statement could be devised, in which case the two opposing positions were simply recorded alongside each other. Perhaps the most important single victory of the Nouvelle Theology modernizers was the rejection of the old traditional Roman Catholic doctrine of Scripture as verbally inspired and infallible. Vatican II instead teaches that Scripture is inspired only in terms of those things which God wishes us to believe for our salvation. In other words, the floodgates were opened to questioning the truth and accuracy of Scripture on matters that are not necessary for salvation. Matters of cosmology, history, geography, etc. Vatican II did a number of other things in its pursuit of aggiornamento, or updating the church. Notably, getting rid of Latin as the language of worship and reforming the shape and the content of Roman Catholic worship to make it more people-centered. As a result, a modern post-Vatican II service of worship in, say, a British Roman Catholic church will now be little different from a traditional Protestant service. Hymns, Bible readings, sermon, all in English. This has all contributed to the view that what happened at Vatican II was a genuinely biblical reformation, such as the 16th century Protestant reformers had called for. But the theological background to Vatican II's work was, as we've seen, very different. Not an acceptance of Reformation theology, but the Nouvelle Théologie with its modernist ideas. So then, the problem that Vatican II bequeathed to Roman Catholics was a set of council documents which could often be interpreted in varying ways, an ambiguous blend of more traditional notions with the more progressive philosophy of the Nouvelle Theology thinkers and reformers. Rather than resulting in clarity, what Vatican II did in many ways was to produce theological uncertainty within the Roman Catholic communion. So, what's the situation now, nearly half a century later? Well, today, Roman Catholics themselves are clear that in the wake of Vatican II, three broad doctrinal camps have evolved within their church. The Roman Catholic writer Philip Troer, in his book Turmoil and Truth, writes, "Among those calling themselves Catholics today, there are in fact not two, but three recognisable bodies of belief or opinion. First, there are Catholics in the hitherto universally recognised sense. They accept all the Church's teachings. Then come the modernists or semi-modernists dedicated to altering some aspect of faith or morals. We can also call them innovators or dissenters. It seems the politest name consistent with accuracy. Finally, there are the followers of the French Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre." Now, looking at things from the standpoint of outsiders, we can reformulate Troer's analysis there to a degree and describe the three camps as follows. First, the traditionalists. The traditionalists. Now, as Troer says, the neo-Thomist followers of Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre are integral to this camp. They are basically those who have rejected Vatican II as heretical and wish to maintain the doctrines and practices of Rome prior to the council. Not just the use of Latin in worship, which is how the media usually portrays them, but the entire religious tradition that found its inspiration in the 16th century Council of Trent and the theology of Thomas Aquinas. To promote these views, Lefebvre founded the Society of St. Pius XII in 1970, the last traditional pope, just before John the 23rd. In 1988, after himself consecrating four bishops in defiance of Pope John Paul II, Lefebvre was excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church. This group is small, though vocal. There are also, in the traditionalist camp, a number of mainly American Roman Catholic apologists, who, although working within Roman Catholicism, are concerned to promote traditional doctrine, harking back to the Council of Trent. Typical examples here would be ex-Presbyterian Scott Hahn, James Aiken and Carl Keating. A more extreme group, although still officially within the Roman Catholic Communion, are the so-called sedevacantists, who've declared that all popes since Vatican II have been heretics, and thus that the chair of St. Peter in Rome is vacant. They work towards the day when a true pope will once again reign and reject the modernism of the Nouvelle Theology as enshrined by Vatican II. So, the traditionalists. Then the second camp, the radical liberals. The radical liberals. In Troer's analysis, these are the modernists. They're the theologians who want to carry forward a more extreme and far-reaching interpretation of Vatican II. They also often act in defiance of the reigning orthodoxy. A representative figure here would be the theologian Hans Kuhn, who was appointed a peritus, an official theological advisor at Vatican II. Although still a priest in good standing today, he was deprived of his mandate to teach Roman Catholic theology in 1979. This was mainly as a result of his explicit rejection of papal infallibility. This camp puts forward its ideas in the magazine Concilium, which advocates a more radical version of the Nouvelle Theology. Karl Rahner, Yves Congar and Hans Kuhn have all been linked with Concilium. And then the third camp, the conservative liberals. The conservative liberals. Now, in Troer's analysis, these are the good Catholics. That simply demonstrates that Troer is one of them. They are, in reality, not in any sense traditional Catholics. They are the representatives, today, of a more moderate interpretation of the Nouvelle Theology. For example, Joseph Ratzinger, the current Pope Benedict XVI. Ratzinger is often portrayed in the media as an arch-conservative theologian harking back to pre-Vatican II days. He is nothing of the sort. Ratzinger has always been in the Nouvelle Theology camp. It is simply on its less radical wing. He's a conservative liberal. Now, the theology of these more conservative liberals is now the prevailing orthodoxy within Roman Catholicism. Their textbook is the officially sanctioned Catechism of the Catholic Church, first published in English in 1994. And they put forward their ideas in the magazine Communio. Henri de Lubac, Urs von Balthasar and Ratzinger have all been linked with Communio. Roman Catholic theology today is therefore not a single entity, any more than Protestant theology is. Think of the many theologies that all go under the name of Protestant or Evangelical. There's a similar diversity within modern Rome. Now, of course, Roman Catholicism does have an official line, as represented by its catechism and various papal pronouncements. However, there's usually also visible dissent at both ends of the theological spectrum, from the traditionalists and from the radical liberals. One thing is clear, though. If there is an official line within modern Rome, it is not the pre-Vatican II consensus with which our Protestant forefathers had to engage. Rome's official line today would have to be described as being deeply imbued with liberal or modernist ideas. Now, we can see this most clearly in the doctrine of salvation, soteriology, as it's called, the doctrine of salvation. Again, three camps are discernible here within modern Rome. First, we have the Roman Catholic traditionalists. Like Orthodox Protestants, they are exclusivists. That is, they teach that there is no salvation outside the Christian faith, in particular as that faith is represented by the Roman Catholic Church. This is summarised in the old Latin phrase, extra ecclesiam nulla salus, outside the church there is no salvation. Pope Pius X, in his encyclical Jucunda Sane of 1904, explained this teaching as follows. It is our duty to recall to everyone, great and small, the absolute necessity which is ours to have recourse to this church, the Roman Catholic Church, to effect our eternal salvation. Now, Protestants have also traditionally been exclusivists, arguing, however, that the Christian faith in which sinners alone are saved is not faithfully embodied in the Roman Catholic Communion. Biblical texts providing the main arguments for Christian exclusivism will be passages like John 14:6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And Acts 4:12. Nor is there salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Then we have the radical liberals of modern Rome. Like many liberal Protestants, they're often pluralists. That is, they teach that all religions can lead to God and salvation. A typical example here would be the Roman Catholic theologian Paul Nitter. He's the editor, along with the radically liberal Protestant theologian John Hick, of the book The Myth of Christian Uniqueness, Toward a Pluralistic Theology of Religions. In this teaching, Jesus Christ is no longer held to be the only saviour. He is but one way to God. And then finally, we have Rome's conservative liberals. These, like many liberal Protestants and some liberal evangelicals, such as Clark Pinnock, are inclusivists. They teach, that is, that people of other religions can be saved by Jesus Christ even if they do not explicitly believe in him. In other words, Christ is still the only saviour, but he saves people without explicit Christian faith on their part. The great German exponent of the Nouvelle Theologie, Karl Rahner, coined the phrase anonymous Christians to describe people who are saved in this way. Now, that third position, held by the conservative liberals, inclusivism, that is, in fact, the official position of Rome today. This shift away from the traditional exclusivism began with the declarations of Vatican II. For example, its key document, Lumen Gentium. And it's now enshrined in the official catechism of the Catholic Church. Let me give you some quotations from the catechism. Those who have not yet received the gospel are related to the people of God in various ways. The Jewish faith, unlike other non-Christian religions, is already a response to God's revelation in the Old Covenant. The plan of salvation also includes those who acknowledge the Creator, in the first place among whom are the Muslims. These profess to hold the faith of Abraham, and together with us, they adore the one merciful God, mankind's judge on the last day. The church's bond with non-Christian religions is, in the first place, the common origin and end of the human race. All share a common destiny, namely God. The Catholic Church recognizes in other religions that search among shadows and images for the God who is unknown yet near, since he gives life and breath and all things and wants all men to be saved. Those also can attain to everlasting salvation, who through no fault of their own do not know the gospel of Christ or his church, yet sincerely seek God, and moved by his grace, strive by their deeds to do his will, as it is known to them through the dictates of conscience. Nor does divine providence deny the help necessary for salvation to those who, without blame on their part, have not yet arrived at an explicit knowledge of God, that is, polytheists, agnostics, atheists, but who strive to live a good life, thanks to his grace. That's a key quote there from Vatican II's Dogmatic Constitution on the Church. An official footnote elaborates. The Council is careful to add that men unacquainted with the biblical revelation, and even those who have not yet arrived at explicit faith in God, may, by the grace of Christ, attain salvation if they sincerely follow the lights God gives them. It's clear, then, that modern Rome has dramatically shifted her position on the doctrine of salvation. The reality is that she teaches today that people of any faith, or perhaps none, can be saved by means of sincerity. Inclusivism has therefore replaced exclusivism as Rome's official teaching. Ian Kerr, Roman Catholic priest and distinguished student of John Henry Newman, explains the current orthodoxy as follows. The Council, that is Vatican II, reasserted the Catholic Church's rejection of both the narrowness and exclusivity of the evangelical Protestantism, which restricts salvation to Christian believers, as well as any kind of liberal Protestant approach which undermines the uniqueness of Christ as the sole mediator. Now, while describing Rome's official position today perfectly accurately there, Kerr is actually rewriting the history of his own religious communion. Its position, prior to Vatican II, was blatantly exclusivist. Outside the church, no salvation. Vatican II did not reassert traditional Catholic teaching as Kerr claims. It revolutionized it. That teaching is now religious inclusivism. Now, we ought to be able to see how this puts into a totally new and radically different perspective all the old pre-Vatican II controversies between Protestantism and Roman Catholicism. Frankly, what does it matter what any Roman Catholic or any Protestant believes about, say, justification by faith, when you don't even have to be a Christian to be saved? If Muslims, Buddhists, and atheists are going to heaven by following the light God gives them, all the traditional debates about justification are short-circuited. As a matter of fact, within Rome's radical, liberal, and conservative liberal camps, many Roman Catholic biblical scholars more or less admit now that Luther had the better of the argument on justification. Sometimes these Catholic biblical scholars can sound like convinced Lutherans. The great Joseph Fitzmyer, for instance, professor emeritus of biblical studies at the Catholic University of America, in his 1993 commentary on Romans, describes the believer's righteousness like this. Consequently, this uprightness does not belong to human beings, and it is not something they have produced or merited. It is an alien uprightness, one belonging rightly to another, to Christ, and attributed to believers because of what that other has done for them. So, Paul understands God justifying the godless, or crediting uprightness to human beings, quite apart from deeds. Well, there's Christ's imputed righteousness for the believing soul. In his comments on Romans 3:28, we conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from the deeds of the law. Fitzmyer even defends the legitimacy of Luther's interpretation of Paul's meaning. By faith alone. Now, Fitzmyer is by no means an isolated example among the Bible scholars of modern Rome. But you see, the point is this. According to post-Vatican II Roman Catholic teaching, it doesn't actually matter what anyone believes about justification as far as their eternal destiny is concerned. At least during the Reformation era, Rome took justification seriously as a crucial doctrine, such that to misunderstand it might expose one's soul to eternal peril. But now, officially, one can deny the very existence of a God who justifies and still partake of his saving grace, as long as one is conscientious and sincere. The logic points to a drift towards total religious pluralism. I don't know, perhaps a day will come when Rome will redefine Christ to mean the Christ principle that operates in all faiths, and the papacy will then proclaim itself the vicar of the Christ principle, the earthly embodiment of all humanity's religious and spiritual aspirations. Let me give you a down-to-earth illustration of this modern Roman Catholic inclusivism. This is from an American radio show called Religion on the Line, broadcast in Los Angeles. The show regularly features a Jewish rabbi, a Roman Catholic priest, and a Protestant minister. The Protestant minister I'm about to quote is Gregory Kukl, a conservative evangelical. He gives the following account of his experience on the radio show. "I was stunned when the first time a Protestant called in to share Christ with the rabbi, he was opposed, not by the rabbi, but rather by the Roman Catholic priest. 'Rabbi, I'll handle this one.' 'The Jews have their own covenant,' the priest argued. 'They have their own way to God, which does not require belief in Jesus. That is also true for every other faith. God can be found through virtually any religions. The blood of Christ is not just for Christians, but is applied to anyone who sincerely and obediently pursues his own religion. He is forgiven through Jesus, though he never believes in Jesus. Put simply, the good Buddhist is saved by the blood of Christ. This is called inclusivism. I almost fell off my chair the first time I heard this. Yet every single Roman Catholic priest on that program since then, a show I'd done more than 20 times, held the same thing, even a bishop." Kukl concludes, "The Roman Catholic view seems to be that healing, spiritual healing, salvation, comes by way of any sincere pursuit. The Dalai Lama is sincerely pursuing God through his religious means, and so are Jews, and so are Hindus, and so are Protestants. Since we're all sincerely pursuing, according to our own beliefs, then God manifests his grace towards each of us without bias. He applies the blood of Christ and saves us all." And then Kukl says, "Sadly, this is not the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is not the gospel of Paul or Peter and the apostles. It hasn't been the gospel of the church for 2,000 years, not even the Roman church. This is the message of the world, not the scriptures." Well, you see, there is modern day post-Vatican II Catholic teaching on salvation. True, Rome still says that the fullness of salvation is found only within her communion. You have to become a Roman Catholic in order to enjoy a complete and comprehensive experience of God and his grace. That's how Rome maintains her position of superiority over all other faiths. But we do need to understand that according to Rome officially, any person can have a basic experience of salvation by means of his or her sincerity in almost any religious or even non-religious context, by following the universal light of conscience. Remember the Roman Catholic Catechism. Men unacquainted with the biblical revelation, and even those who have not arrived at explicit faith in God, may by the grace of Christ attain salvation, if they sincerely follow the lights God gives them. Now, bearing that in mind, the idea of Rome unchanged, unchanging, is simply a myth, whether propagated by Roman Catholics or Protestants. Rome has changed. She's become a bewilderingly complex entity. Within her wide embrace, old-fashioned neo-Thomists, crypto-Lutherans, moderate liberals, and outright modernists are all found sitting together. Why, then, do so many conservative evangelicals, perhaps especially in the Reformed camp, persist in the illusion that Rome has not changed, that she is today just what she was in the days of Luther, and so continue to fight the outmoded battles of the past? I think that Presbyterian scholar Alan Howe hits on the answer. Quote, "One of the reasons why evangelicals often continue to engage purely with the doctrinal controversies of the past, giving the impression that Rome has not changed, may well be that this is within their theological comfort zone. In other words, it's easier to just go on fighting the familiar, comfortable old battles than to engage in the difficult, perhaps unsettling task of honestly grappling with what Roman Catholicism actually is today, especially in the wake of the Second Vatican Council. We're also encouraged to fight the old battles by the Roman Catholic traditionalists, who are the only ones likely to attack evangelical beliefs, because the conservative Roman Catholic traditionalists themselves are trapped in the past and find it hard not to fight the old battles. But we ought to hear these words of Reformed theologian Robert Strimple. Evangelical Protestants must recognise what such conservative Roman Catholics themselves recognise, that they form the Orthodox minority in the Catholic Church. And when Orthodox Protestants enter into debate with those who now form the majority of professional Catholic theologians, the issues addressed must be the even more radically fundamental ones relating to the meaning of every affirmation of the historic faith of the Christian Church. Let us therefore know where we really stand. The Roman Catholic Church has changed fundamentally in the past half century, from an exclusivist body, no salvation outside the church, to one that embraces religious inclusivism. All can be saved by their own sincere religious quest. In our engagement with Rome's teachings, let's not merely refight the comfortable battles of the past, but so understand what Rome in fact teaches that we may be equipped to fight the battles of today. I conclude with those words of Martin Lloyd-Jones that I quoted at the beginning of the talk. The Church of Rome today is not identical with the Church in Luther's day. What is coming into the Roman Church is modernism, liberalism, higher criticism, not evangelicalism. Do not be deluded, my friends. Those are the facts concerning the Roman Catholic Church. Well, that's the end of my presentation, and we've got some time now if anyone would like to ask any questions about any of that. I hope folks weren't too overwhelmed by names and